There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news? I'm brought to you live.
Hello and welcome to Labor Radio, the February 2021 edition. I'm your co-host, Stefan Doucette, and I'm joined by
Mustafa Henaway, your other co-host and producer.
And just the rock that this show sits on. Today we've got a fairly simple show for you all. We got an interview with an economist from the CSQ. The Centrale des Syndicats du Québec.
Pierre-Antoine Harvey.
That's right.
Yeah.
So he's going to talk to us about lots of the research that he does with the CSQ, and really looking forward to that interview.
Yes, and also we'll be able to discuss, you know, everything from, you know, the economics of the post-COVID recovery to the conditions and policies that will impact not just the members of CSQ, but all working people here in Quebec and beyond. So it should be actually quite a critical discussion in terms of thinking through questions about strategy and politics, in terms of debt to public services, what CAC might try or not implement, and then how that's going to impact struggles of trade unions over the short to medium term.
Yeah, so in our shows lately, we felt that we were doing a lot of sort of timely stuff around current struggles, and that's obviously crucial. But we were hoping to, through this interview, sort of have that more medium term view, like what's the outlook looking like over the next year or so with the pandemic, with the public sector bargaining and whatever. So looking forward to that. A few things in the news that we just wanted to quickly touch on before we get to that interview. Notably, one thing that's been in the news a lot, you can't have missed it, is the case of Mamadi Camara, who was accused of assaulting a cop in Park Extension in Montreal, and then was let go 6 days later after it was revealed that he had nothing to do with it, which was his claim from the beginning. And what I thought was interesting was that just yesterday, so we're recording this on Wednesday, the 17th, so on the 16th, about a week after he was released, the PSAC Quebec just published on their Facebook page, solidarity with our confrère, Mamadi Camara. So kind of that brought up some thoughts for me in the sense that he was, it was publicly known that he had been let go of his job, and now his union way down the line says solidarity with our brother, now that he's been reinstated and whatnot. I just thought it was interesting in terms of a very big union that represents a lot of people who are victims of racism, who've had their own struggles internally with racism. And now this comes to light, a little bit late to the game, I would say.
And I mean, it kind of shows the questions and struggles, especially in this context, right? You know, like how do we, how do trade unions, it's not just about questions of race and racism inside the workplace, but for working people who are racialized, what does that mean outside of the workplace? And then what's the role of someone's union or the trade union movement as a whole to confront that, but also to defend its members in those cases, which is, I think is something that really needs to be explored more. While you've had more of that in the United States, the fact that he lost his job as a result of this incident, the fact that his career and reputation has been mired as a result of this, and the role that unions have to play in combating racism to defend their members, I think becomes especially important now. Hopefully this is a wake-up call to labor unions to deal with that.
Absolutely. A few other things. We were trying to get a interview about the general strike in Haiti. So people who listen to CKUT are maybe more likely than the average person to know that there's a big struggle going on in Haiti right now against the U.S.-backed and Canadian-backed President Jovenel Moïse. And there was a general strike on February 1st across a lot of different sectors. So that's one element of that struggle, was labor getting involved. So it's worth noting in the sense that Canada is deeply involved in Haiti, does not have a good track record in terms of defending democracy there, to say the least. Haiti's working class is fighting that imperialist aggression for sure.
Yeah, and a continual sort of just collapse of Haiti without any real, the Canadian state just continues its imperial policies without having to address any of the fundamental structural issues that keep miring Haiti in one crisis after the other, right? That people are still even reeling from the earthquake in 2010, right? That there still hasn't been a full recovery in terms of infrastructure, in terms of people's housing since the earthquake, and that people's anger was going to come to the fore. It was happening before the pandemic, when we saw the uprising really began, and now with this general strike and the unwillingness of the government to to budge, and the interest it serves in terms of its you know, clients in Canada, the United States, and France, it remains a critical question. I mean, also in terms of the Haitian diaspora here, also as well, right? And very linked to questions of the, you know, making the links in terms of, you know, people who are here as essential workers, people who came as refugees, and how these people were essentially displaced by what's happening now, and it's in everyone's face. So I, but it's also at the same time encouraging, right? That it's this unending revolution that's taking place in Haiti.
Totally. Well, I guess we should get to our interview. Before that, I just wanted to mention that we have launched a Facebook page for the show. So you can find that by searching Labor Radio on Facebook. We have a Mixcloud where we post recordings of our shows that we rip directly from the CKUT website, but it's just another easy way to listen if you're not catching us live. You can find it on our Facebook page there. Also, just wanted to make note, so we wanted to play a song by Anne Feeney, who is a U.S. Sort of movement singer, I guess you could say. She passed away early in February from COVID. She was 69. And the song that I sort of heard of hers first was "We Just Come to Work Here, We Don't Come to Die," which is particularly relevant right now with the what we talked about in our last show with the Law 59 that's being proposed, which will have negative impacts on workplace safety for workers across Quebec. So rest in power to Anne Feeney. Thanks for all the songs. And definitely take a chance if you, or take the time if you have the chance to just look her up, see her singing the steel workers after the WTO protest in 99. A lot of her songs are important to the labor movement and to sort of left movements generally in the English world.
Enjoy the song, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Pierre-Antoine Harvey. You're listening to Labor Radio here on CKT 90.3 FM.
Working at this job is dirty and dangerous, and I'm taking risks anyway. Oh, if I had the time and the proper equipment, I could do my job safely each day. Everybody here says they're sticklers for safety, and I'm not here to say that they lie. I'm saying we just come to work here, we don't come to die. Now I don't want your chemicals clouding my brain, I want to keep all of my fingers and toes. I want to hear those cheers at both of my ears when my working days come to a close. Work that I do here is dangerous enough, don't you rush me, and I'm telling you why. Overseas, 60,000 workers that we buried last year found the cost of doing business too high. We just come to work here, we don't come to die. Now while you're up there talking in an air-conditioned office on a telephone that OSHA approved, go on and tell me how.
You are listening to Labor Radio here on CKT 90.3 FM on a late Wednesday night. And we're joined with us with a special guest, economist and researcher for the CSQ, Centrale du Syndicat de Québec, is Pierre-Antoine Harvey, and a longtime activist, writer, researcher, on the questions of labor and economic power here in Quebec. Thank you so much, Pierre-Antoine, for joining us on Labor Radio.
It's a pleasure to be with you, and thanks for the invitation.
And I guess the first question, and because we wanted to really broaden the scope of the discussion. A lot of our episodes are focused on specific struggles within the labor movement, but we wanted to take a bit more of a bird's eye view, particularly in the context of the pandemic. And as someone who's particularly embedded within a union that has many of its members within the public sector, how is been the analysis and the perception of the CSQ, in particular on its members, of the pandemic and what the government has been trying to implement?
Okay. So that question brings many issues. And I would say the first is the many impact of the pandemic on the workers. As you said, CSQ represent mostly workers from the public sector. So core of our 200,000 members are in the education sectors, beginning from childcare, CPE, and home childcare workers, up to most of our members are primary and secondary school. So teachers, support staff, and professionals, but also up to university. And also some members in the health sector. So one thing that we, if we look back after 1 year of pandemic, most of our members didn't stop to work, a bit during the closing of the schools in the beginning, but most of them, what they're living now is an intensification of their workload, because of the different adjustment that we had to make in the health sector. That's, I don't have to explain why the workload has exploded. In the education sector, primary school and secondary school, they had to adapt to the new way of teaching. So at the end of spring, it was 100% teaching through computers. Most of the staff didn't have any formation on that. Some of the staff and some of the students didn't even have the equipment to do school at home. So there was many adjustment, and now there's adjustment on the way they're teaching, on the way the support staff is bringing help to special needs students, because they're not in school all the time, so they need to be reached through other ways, through other means. And also all the social problems that, like, one thing that we can easily link is some of the students who have learning problem in school, not all the time, but often it's linked with problems in either economic problems in the family or problems, relational problems in the family. Those students are not all the time in school, so it's really hard to see those problematics. So the staff had to adjust, and they did it willingly. Most problem is that all the orders and the consigne, the rules that came from the government were confused and still are confused, changed periodically, very quickly. Even the direction of the schools were mixed, and they were like depressed because they were waiting for information from the minister, and they didn't have any information. So all the problems, there's an intensification of work, of the workload in education, college education, health system that was there before the crisis, but it has been multiplied by the crisis. So now we're dealing with a lot of stress, burnouts, people quitting their job, and the support from the government is a lot of good words, like in their everyday press conference. There's a lot of good words for those guardian angels, but in the reality, there's not much that has been done to relieve the workload that they have, and to send them signals that they're really important for the government. So that's the immediate problem, is finding ways to live the pandemic without falling to a burnout. And you can imagine a teacher who is also a parent, and often teachers marry other teachers. That so there are two teachers in the family with two kids, and they're the four in the house, two of them teaching, two of them learning on the other. So you can imagine the workload that it has been for those people, at time being parents and also being a teacher in the same time. So that has been a very difficult time, and that's for everybody. But if we look at the people working in the education sector, that has been the most problem. And another problematic, it's the éducatrice en service de garde, the daycare centers in the schools, because that's something we have in Quebec, is that before school and after school, we have a service for the kids who don't go home because both their parents are working. And those workers are considered essential services, but nothing was made to accommodate them to give the service, and they're in close proximity to the students, and they were treated like, okay, just do your job. We clean every toys 10 times a day, and that's part of a reality. We won't do anything to help you in that sense. So there's a lot of tiredness, I can say, in public sectors for the moment. After the pandemic, the main situation I think will be the rebooting the economy. For the workers in education, there's one problematic that is really important for us, is if you look at the jobs that in the sectors that the most jobs were lost, it's mostly jobs with not a lot of qualification needed, not a lot of diplomas that are needed. So it's like restaurant and hotel sector. It's a retail trade sector for the moment. Another sector with more qualification needed is the communication and art and entertainment sector. Those are the three main sectors that have durable effect in the loss of job. If you look at the construction sector, it was a dramatic drop in May. Last May was a dramatic drop in construction sector, but a few months after that, when we start working again, it went into a boost, and it's even higher. During this last summer, was higher than the year before. So it's quite an unequal rebooting of the economy. We were talking about that's for economists. Would it be a recession? Would it be a V recession? It is very steep falling, and we go up very quickly afterward. Would it be a U? Would it be a L? And the latest we've seen, and I think it describes best the reality, it's a K recession, because some of them went up really, very, really fast. but some sectors are still down.
What would a K-like recession look like in Quebec? You talked about the certain sectors that would be the most affected in terms of like retail, restaurants. But what are your thoughts in terms of what a K-like recovery would actually look like and mean in Quebec?
That's I think what we're seeing is a K recovery, because some, as I said, some sectors are recovered really quickly, and even some sectors are higher, have more employment now than before the crisis. But some others higher because they're still affected by the restrictions on the health restrictions. So of course, people working in the hard sector, there's still most of them out of job, because we cannot go in theaters, we cannot go listen to music in bars. So those are affected because of the health rules. Other sectors will be slower to pick up for other reasons. Tourist sector, same thing, we won't start traveling again. If we look at the aerospatial industry, that is really important in Montreal, that also probably will stay low for a long time. The main objective is that some sectors are picking up very quickly, those are lagging behind. And when we started the recession, there was supposedly a penury, how to say that, penury, shortage of workers in different sectors. And pretty soon, I think we'll have shortage of workers in some sectors and too much workers in other sectors. And the problem will be, how do you help people to switch from one sector in which there's a high unemployment level to a sector where they're looking for workers? And that doesn't say, it doesn't come by magic. You have to have access to to studies, to formations, to qualifications. So when we're talking about ways that the government can help for the recovery, I think investment in education and access to education for people already in the workplace is a main issue for us. And of course, I'm saying that because my members I'm working for are working in the education sector. But it's also something that it's striking. We'll have too much workers in some sectors and not enough in the others. So very simple things. It's very strange that if you want to have a professional formation professionnelle, which we a professional certification that's college level. So let's say you want to become a plumber. Not plumber, plumber that's secondary, but let's say lab technician to work in the hospitals. You need to do a technical degree at the Cégep. This is not accessible part-time. You need to go full-time to get this formation. So that means people who are now working or working part-time, they don't have access to that formation to enhance their skill and maybe someday get a better job in a sector that is more active. So giving access to people to part-time professional formation in the college, that would be a very simple solution for the government.
The projet de relance that the government proposed in 2020, which was like widely criticized and rejected, was pretty much fully directed at the construction industry and infrastructure and building, whatever. Very male sectors was one of the criticisms, and a lot of the job losses were female. So like the majority, I guess, of job losses in Canada, I don't know about Quebec in particular, but in Canada on the whole, the numbers of female workers who lost their jobs was much higher. So like, that's one of the questions I think that like came up for me was like, obviously the priorities of the CAC are going to be sort of ideologically in line with their approach to everything. And mm-hmm. like you mentioned, putting the money towards education, that's not exactly one of their strong points, you know. No. When they were in the opposition, they said a lot of stuff about higher wages for teachers, but now that they're in government, it's a whole nother thing. But so obviously, like, people on the left, we like to talk about like what could be like a recovery plan for the people, you know, that prioritizes nationalization or at least public services that are already public. But so from what I understand, that project was rejected and abandoned, but is there anything that you know about that's coming up the pipe in terms of a new recovery plan? Because I mean, already it seems almost premature to talk about recovery since things are just so catastrophic, but obviously people are going to be thinking about it now.
Yeah, but actually the main part of the recovery plan of the government was to not delay, but prevent, like they have a 10-year plan of investment into infrastructure. And it's in 10 year, they're supposed to spend $30 billion into infrastructure. The main plan was to accelerate this plan. So this year, instead of instead of $10 billion of infrastructure investment, they will be spending $13 billion. So that's $3 billion more into in infrastructures that will be invested. The plan was also accompanied by a bill that was made, they say, to facilitate those projects. But there was a lot of complaint because it was going too fast on lowering the obligation for the protection of the environment. It was also in some areas facilitating too much the powers of the municipalities to expropriate some citizens, but it was mostly the environmental part and the fact that those projects were not distributed equally inside the province. So this bill died, but the fact that they're investing much quicker than before is still there. So it's of course. Some say, and I like the word. It's not a recession; it's a C-session. So there's mostly women who lost their job. It's true that more women lost their job in this recession. If we look from February last year to the latest data that we have, which is January this year, about 170,000 women lost their job or were affected by the crisis, and it's about 1,014 men that were affected. So they lost their job. Three things happened. They lost their job. Some of them went from full time to part time, and what we see mostly for the women is that they left the workforce. So they're not working, but they're not unemployed, but because they're not looking for jobs anymore. They decided to stay at home, and probably it's because they need to take care of their kids because the kids aren't going to school one on 2 days. So they made the choice in this situation. It's better, it's more economic for me to stay at home. So that's a long-term problem. So we need, if we have a C-session, we need a recovery. That's all buzzwords. I like them. It's a recovery for her. So of course we can invest in construction infrastructures. We have many needs in Quebec. If you look at our schools, if you look at our hospitals and our bridge or our road, but that's a sector that is already very dynamic. So okay to put more money there, but you cannot put all your eggs in that only basket. You need to invest in other things. So of course, public services, the main advantage with public services it's that it's mostly women working in that sector, and it's good quality jobs with good conditions for women, and it's also women with qualifications that are so it's mostly, not all of them, but mostly good jobs for women that are in the public sector. The other advantage is that public sector is already implemented in all the regions of Quebec. So if you put money in the schools, every city, every village will take advantage of those investments. And it's money that is spent directly in the community. When you invest into a bridge, building a $3 billion, even more bridge, part of that money goes away for the materials in other countries. Most of the time, it's big multinationals that are managing the project. When you put money in the public sector, it stays here, and it encourages the local economy. Other things, and we're having there's a lot of discussion right now on the service de garde. How do I say that in English?
Daycare.
So yeah, on the daycare, because there's a lot of space that are. A lot of parents are looking for daycare services and they don't have access to subsidized daycare. And that's a very important situation. As I said, a lot of women left the labor force. They went back home or they stopped looking for a job. Not all of them, but I'm pretty sure part of them is because they didn't have access to daycare. So if you want to bring those women back to the workforce and you want to help them get a job, you have to give them access to daycare. So I think that's a chantier that is really easy for the government to put forward. We have a structure that makes every other province in Canada jealous of what we have for daycare. It's not perfect. It can be better. So I think that's a nice space where the government could put some money.
In terms of the recovery plan and sort of the high expenditures and whatnot, you know, in other periods and other crises, you know, governments usually use this moment of debt to implement austerity, right? Do you see that being the case with CAC, or they'll just wait to use that card until later on, or will they use the question of debt for further restructuring or flexibility within the labor market, also to ensure Quebec remains dynamic or in the public sector negotiations?
That's a good question, and I'm not used to send some praise for the CAC. I must say for the short term, the plan of the CAC is somehow reassuring. They're really clear that it's not time now for austerity. It's important to and that's directly what the Minister of Finance says. We need to get through the crisis, and B, we need to restart the economy, and then we'll discuss about public finances. So that's a good news for the short term. But of course, we're worried about long-term discourse. And when I say long-term, I'm speaking about in the next 2 or 3 years. We might see a shift. We might see a shift in the public discourse and the public opinion about how we can invest in the public sector. Of course, it's a year, exceptional year when we will be doing in Quebec a deficit that we have never seen in modern history. Government is speaking about $15 billion of deficit, but in reality, it's about $8 billion, because there's a There's a $4 billion that is a kind of a reserve in case of a second wave. So that'll be gone. Let's say it's $12 billion, and adding to that about $3 billion that is a payment to the Fonds des Générations, which is not a spending. It's some money that we put into a saving account that is called Fonds des Générations. So the real deficit will be about $12 billion, which is very high. We have never seen that. But still, if we look at the progression of the debt in Quebec, we'll be at a lower level of debt after this crisis that we've been 5 years ago. So at the beginning, at the end of the 2008-2009 economic crisis, the level of the debt was much higher than what it will be in the next few years. So we'll be about around 50% of the GDP. But after the 2009 crisis, we were about 55-56%. So there's no real emergency to pay back the debt, no real emergency to come back to a budgetary equilibrium. We can still make some deficit for a few years without any problems. The other reason is the debt is low, but also the cost of the debt is really low. Interest rates are so low, not in Canada, but some countries are borrowing money at a negative level. Canada is almost close to, it's between 0.5 and 1% interest rate for the when they want to borrow money for the debt. Quebec is around 1.5%. So we're all jealous because we would like that for our hypothec. But the government, so the cost of the interest of the debt is now lower. Even after the crisis, it will be lower than what it was 2 years ago because of the low interest rate. And those are there for a few years left. Most economists say five to 10 years with low interest rate. So that's not, the debt is not a preoccupation at all. But we're so used to that discourse. It's so easy to scare people with the debt that we're on our guards because we know the government next year or the year after will come with those rhetorics and come back with austerity. We know, like either Liberal government and CAQ government, they have a long term plan. It's the plan of the Ministry of Finance. It's to shrink the space that takes that public services take in the global economy. Quebec is, if we compare to other provinces, is kind of is still a progressive province. So our public services take a bit more space than other provinces. And what we know is that Ministry of Finance, CAQ and Liberal government, their aim is to shrink the state. And the way to do it, there's nothing more useful than a good crisis and some the scary boogeyman of the debt. To tell people, oh, we would really like to improve public services, but unfortunately, we need to settle the debt problems, which is more frightening. So, of course, in the next year, we're preparing for a return of the of this discourse, and we're working on arguments and building coalitions to bring back struggles against austerity, which was not so long ago that we used to do just before 2015.
Speaking of austerity and fighting back, I mean, I think in the past few weeks, we've seen a lot of strike votes in the CSQ. so obviously that's to do with the public sector bargaining that's going on right now.
Yeah.
But I just wondered, like, maybe your perspective, and we only have like about five more minutes, but your perspective on what's brought us to this point. You know, like, Quebec has had a pretty terrible time with COVID, and a lot of people are blaming that on the poor state of public services in general. So obviously, like, not schools as much necessarily, even though they could obviously be improved. But I'm wondering on your perspective of what's been the economic model and the policy model that's brought us to now at this sort of crisis point.
I must say the strike vote. Of course, we're in the public sector negotiation, which is in Quebec, involves many different negotiations going together, but involving 500,000 workers at the same time. So of course, the pandemic is putting some pressure on our members, and it's part of the reason they voted to go on strike. But it's also we're living a negotiation that is the same that 5 years ago and the same than 10 years ago. I think the and especially now the negotiation is not more, it's not in the government head. It's not a question of building work conditions that help people, give the best services we can give to students, to patients, to families. It's all about lowering the cost of the public services. And the reason is Quebec is supposed to have the highest fiscal level in North America. So if you want to lower the taxes to give back to your friends, because then you need to lower the cost, and that's a 30 years story in Quebec. Slowly with the decentralization of negotiation, that gives an enormous power to the government to decide the working conditions, or to have a very strong position at the negotiation table, and the unions are often not able to get as much as they wanted. So on a scale of 30 years, we saw that the working conditions of the public sector on the wage level went down comparing to other sectors, on the pressure on the workload has gone higher. So that's a direct result of all the model of austerity, the model of lowering the space that the public sector occupies in the economy. So it's not new because of the pandemic. I'm just, what I'm seeing from my perspective is that the pandemic is just giving a new argument to the government. And now what he's saying at the negotiation table is that, oh, we would like to be give you more, but you know, we're having those big deficits. Next year will be very difficult. And you're lucky you still have a job, so don't complain, and please sign at the end of the paper. But our members were very impatient before last year, and they're even more impatient now. And depending, and it's there's a lot of people involved, so there's there's no one consensus. But I would say the main position in CSQ is it's not negotiation right now is not mostly on wage. Of course, everybody would like to be paid more, but the main issue is on working conditions, putting money in the sectors, putting money in the school to have more staff, more help. If you're a teacher, you have a lot of special needs students in your class. You want somebody to help you, support staff to help you, professionals to help you. If you work as a nurse, you want more colleagues because you're tired of doing forced overtime. So I think the main issue is to have more money to have better working conditions in the services. And that is what is very insulting, because the government doesn't hear this cry. Now we're negotiating with the Conseil du Trésor and their accountants. So they see life through numbers. The same criticism would be through economists, but I think I have the chance to be involved in the labor movement, so I see other things than numbers, I hope.
Well, we're just about out of time, and I think Zoom's going to cut us off. So mm-hmm. Thanks a lot, Pierre-Antoine, for chatting with us today.
It's been a pleasure.
And welcome back to Labor Radio here on Off the Hour on CKT 90.3 FM. This is your co-host, Mustafa Henaway, with...
I'm Stéphane Doucette. We're here with you every third Thursday of the month from 5 to 6 p.m., covering labor issues, just generally, all kinds of ways.
From public sector to our communities to... you know, to the smallest of struggles, to the biggest of struggles.
It's all here.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next month.
Yeah. And again, you can always go to our Mixcloud Facebook page, Labor Radio, CKUT, and also find our archives there. This is it for this month's edition of Labor Radio.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Capital, A Critical Analysis of Capitalist Production, Volume 1 by Karl Marx. Part 8, The So-Called Primitive Accumulation. Chapter 33, The Modern Theory of Colonization. Political economy confuses on principle two very different kinds of private property, of which one rests on the producer's own labor, the other on the employment of the labor of others. It forgets that the latter not only is the direct antithesis of the former, but absolutely grows on its tomb only. In Western Europe, the home of political economy, the process of primitive accumulation is more or less accomplished. Here the capitalist regime has either directly conquered the whole domain of national production, or where economic conditions are less developed, it at least indirectly controls those strata of society which, though belonging to the antiquated mode of production, continue to exist side by side with it in gradual decay. To this ready-made world of capital, the political economist applies the notions of law and of property inherited from a pre-capitalistic world with all the more anxious zeal and all the greater unction, the more loudly the facts cry out in the face of his ideology. It's otherwise in the colonies. There the capitalist regime everywhere comes into collision with the resistance of the producer, who as owner of his own conditions of labor, employs that labor to enrich himself instead of the capitalist. The contradiction of these two diametrically opposed economic systems manifests itself here practically in a struggle between them. Where the capitalist has at his back the power of the mother country, he tries to clear out of his way by force the modes of production and appropriation based on the independent labor of the producer. The same interest which compels the sycophant capital and political economist in the mother country to proclaim the theoretical identity of the capitalist mode of production with its contrary, that same interest compels him in the colonies to make a clean breast of it and to proclaim aloud the antagonism of the two modes of production. To this end, he proves how the development of the social productive power of labor, cooperation, division of labor, use of machinery on a large scale, etc., are impossible without the expropriation of the laborers and the corresponding transformation of their means of production into capital. In the interest of the so-called national wealth, he seeks for artificial means to ensure the poverty of the people. This Wakefield calls systematic colonization. First of all, Wakefield discovered that in the colonies, property and money, means of subsistence, machines, and other means of production, does not as yet stamp a man as a capitalist if there be wanting the correlative, the wage worker, the other man who is compelled to sell himself of his own free will. discovered that capital is not a thing, but a social relation between persons established by the instrumentality of things. We know that the means of production and subsistence, while they remain the property of the immediate producer, are not capital. They become capital in the circumstances in which they serve at the same time as means of exploitation and subjection of the laborer. But this capitalist soul of theirs is so intimately wedded in the head of the political economist to their material substance that he christens them capital under all circumstances, even when they are its exact opposite. Further, the splitting up of the means of production into the individual property of many independent laborers working on their own account, he calls equal division of capital. It is with the political economist as with the feudal jurist. The latter stuck on to pure monetary relations, the label supplied by feudal law. If, says Wakeman, quote, if all members of the society are supposed to possess equal portions of capital, no man would have a motive for accumulating more capital than he could use with his own hands. End of quote. So long, therefore, as the laborer can accumulate for himself, this he can do so long as he remains possessor of his means of production. Capitalist accumulation and the capitalist mode of production are impossible. How then in old Europe was the expropriation of the laborer from his conditions of labor, i.e. the coexistence of capital and wage labor, brought about? In one word, the mass of mankind expropriated itself in honor of, quote, the accumulation of capital, end quote. But why then should, quote, systematic colonization, end quote, be called in to replace its opposite, spontaneous, unregulated colonization? Nay, the impulse to self-expropriation on the part of laboring humanity for the glory of capital exists so little that slavery, according to Wakefield himself, is the sole natural basis of colonial wealth. The great beauty of capitalist production consists in this, that it not only constantly reproduces the wage worker as wage worker, but produces always in production to the accumulation of capital a relative surplus population of wage workers. Thus, the law of supply and demand of labor is kept in the right rut, the oscillation of wages is penned within limits satisfactory to capitalist exploitation, and lastly, the social dependence of the laborer on the capitalist, that indispensable requisite, is secured. An unmistakable relation of dependence, which the smug political economist at home in the mother country can transmogrify into one of free contract between buyer and seller, between equally independent owners of commodities, the owner of the commodity capital and the owner of the commodity labor. But in the colonies, this pretty fancy is torn asunder. The absolute population here increases much more quickly than in the mother country, because many laborers enter this world as ready-made adults. And yet the labor market is always understocked. The law of supply and demand of labor falls to pieces. On the one hand, the old world constantly throws in capital thirsting after exploitation and so-called abstinence. On the other, the regular reproduction of the wage laborer as wage laborer comes into collision with impediments the most impertinent and in part invincible. What becomes of the production of wage laborers into independent producers who work for themselves instead of for capital and enrich themselves instead of the capitalist gentry reacts in its turn very perversely on the conditions of the labor market. Not only does the degree of exploitation of the wage laborer remain indecently low, the wage laborer loses into the bargain along with the relation of dependence, also the sentiment of dependence on the abstemious capitalist. Hence, all the inconveniences that our E.G. Wakefield pictures so doltily, so eloquently, so pathetically. The supply of wage labor, he complains, is neither constant nor regular nor sufficient. Quote, the supply of labor is always not only small, but uncertain. Though the produce divided between the capitalist and the laborer be large, the laborer takes so great a share that he soon becomes a capitalist. Few, even those whose lives are unusually long, can accumulate great masses of wealth. End of quote. Think of the harbor. The excellent capitalist has imported bodily from Europe with his own good money, his own competitors. The end of the world has come. No wonder Wakefield laments.
CKUT's 2020 funding drive has been postponed indefinitely, but we are still accepting donations to help us sustain the station's operations while we remain closed due to COVID-19. Our wide network of volunteers provides an essential service to many different communities in Montreal, and the isolation of the past few months has highlighted how important independent news, arts and culture, and music programming is for Montreal's underrepresented communities. If you are in a position to give during this time, visit ckut.ca and click on the green Donate button to make a contribution, or contact funding@ckut.ca if you have any questions. Thank you for your continued support. Love, CKUT.
Good evening. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at ckut.ca, the show about theater on the radio, from drama to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between. I'm your host, Sarah DeAy, recording from home on February 18th, 2021. On tonight's show, my guests. Festival de la Bête Noire is here to haunt your dreams. Executive Director Mylène Chicoine.
I don't like winter. A lot of people don't like winter. There's not much going on between like January and June. You know, there's a, you know, outside festival. There's Bougie, there's other little festivals. I'm like, why not do something? Why not have horror in the middle of the year when no one expects it?
And we invite artists from La Bête Noire, Marissa Blair, and Jeroen Lindemann of Mad Paradox.
Came from a